A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. United Healthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com. Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why United Healthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi, this is Billie Jean King.
This is Marion Bartoli.
I'm Mats Wilander.
This is Mary Carrillo.
This is Yannick Noah, and you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
Well, folks, it is 1:19 a.m. here at Tennis Podcast Towers, Paris, and up until about half an hour ago, possibly less, tennis was happening.
Yeah.
Because tennis be tennising.
This is the most extreme ridiculousness of the lot, though, isn't it? The fact that they're actually starting a five-set match at 9 o'clock, deliberately, out of choice.
Yeah, I mean, Madrid do this, but they don't schedule a start time deliberately for 9 a.m. I suppose for 9 p.m. But I don't know. I once had a very traumatizing experience in Madrid where I was somehow standing outside a locker room interviewing Andy Murray at 3:56 a.m. Mm. But this is the whole problem, isn't it? Because this is so common in tennis, it's normalised, and barely an eyebrow is raised when tennis
slam
finishes at 1 a.m. And eyebrows should be raising. That, speaking of not raising eyebrows, there were people that left Chatrier tonight after watching. I mean, I'm struggling for words for what Lorenzo Musetti against Stefanos Tsitsipas was. Watching a five-setter between Musetti and Tsitsipas, and then queued to get on to Simon Mathieu to watch the dregs of Pablo Carreño Busta against Gilles Simon.
I mean, I got to say, as having commentated on the Chatrier match and walked past that queue, I mean, initially I did think, what are you all doing? And then when I walked past Simon Mathieu, the atmosphere was amazing. And it didn't sort of... And actually, I'm so bowled over by the French crowds here, having never been here before. It's so much better than I ever expected it would be. That I...
Tell that to Alex de Minaur.
Yeah, okay, I could say that point. But, you know, high on the sort of adrenaline of commentating, I was almost like, oh, you know, that would be fun, in a way, to go and see the last few minutes of
you
this
wouldn't
moment.
Be on this bloody podcast if you'd gone to see the last few minutes of that, David.
I'm aware of that. That's why I'm here. I mean, what was it? Simon was two sets up, then he's two sets all, he's down in the fifth, and he somehow wins. I wasn't watching it. And frankly, in terms of rallies, it's not a match that really sets my pulse racing. But it's the crowd. The crowd here send things into another stratosphere that I can't really think of too many others that I've seen like that.
Can I just make 2 points on lateness and night sessions? We're into day 4 and round 1 has only just finished.
And we haven't had much rain.
Just let that sink in for a moment.
Yeah, it's daft.
Today's been so long, Matt's grown a beard. I've just clocked it.
He has. It takes me 4 weeks to grow that.
And, sorry, Matt, point
and,
two.
Well, the second point is what you were saying about how normalised it is in tennis and how nobody or the authorities don't seem to think it's a problem. Roland Garros has invented this night session, especially.
That's what bothers me about it.
Now, obviously, at some point, the US Open and the Australian Open invented their night sessions, but they've become so much part of the tournament, and they are proper sessions. You know, there are multiple matches going on. There's a buzz. There's a vibe. There's noise. There's people drinking beer. It's so integral to those tournaments, the night sessions. I still think they go on too late. But the period there between 7 p.m. and midnight on the ground at Flushing Meadows and at Melbourne Park is amazing. Absolutely. I don't get why the French Open really have done this. Look, I'm sure there are reasons, probably financial, but it's one main match and it's too cold and it doesn't fit in with the vibe of the tournament.
It doesn't feel like the main event. Maybe it needs time to bed in.
Maybe it does.
But it doesn't feel to me like that's the spotlight. That's where the spotlight of the day is.
I'm not sure I agree with you. I just have a problem with the start time. You have your own opinions, and maybe it's because I was in a nice commentary box that wasn't too cold. Maybe that's why I felt differently.
Why wasn't there a full crowd inside Châtrier tonight, David?
It was pretty good. I don't know why there wasn't a full crowd, but I mean it was pretty full for most of it. But you still, because of the start time, because if you, what gets me about it is if the ultimate is a fifth set classic where you go to a final tie break, you are guaranteed to be at the very least 1 a.m., really. And that's just silly. That's stupid, really.
Well, what we had was a fifth set, but absolutely not a classic, is how I would characterise tonight's fight back from Stefanos Tsitsipas to beat Lorenzo Musetti in five sets. He was two sets to love down. And yet the match felt over very soon after he lost the second set somehow. Now, look, he didn't retire at four love down, Lorenzo Musetti. It is progress from his last outing on the Philippe Chatrier court when he went two sets to love up against Novak Djokovic last year, then failed to win another game, retired after six love, four love, I think, in the third and fourth set. He's come on from that. But I would say, look, I'm a bit grumpy because it's 1:25 in the morning and I really feel like that match probably should have been done after three sets if Tsitsipas could just have, you know, found a way to win that opening set. But I feel really shortchanged by Lorenzo Musetti.
Well,
I feel really disappointed in him.
Well, we saw what he's got, but that's
flair.
Nothing new.
Flair and no fangs.
He's one heck of a shot maker, and to see him hit the ball like he does, he can actually out-hit Tsitsipas at his own game, which is quite a sight. And he did that from midway through the first set through to the end of the second set and established a two-set lead. And I remember feeling similarly when he got two tie-break set wins against Novak Djokovic to be two sets to love up. I can also excuse the third set drop-off. You know, I think that's not unusual. What I can't excuse is at the start of the fifth set, I said to Pat Cash in our BBC Five Live commentary, I want to see something from Musetti now. He should feel that last year was something that has to not happen again. And he might not win this, but he has to push him. He has to push Tsitsipas now. He's 20 years old. He's a great shot maker. He's got all the raw materials. He's a young, fit lad. I don't see why he would not push Tsitsipas right now. Even though Tsitsipas had done really well, I think, to gather himself at a time when he was playing terribly for two sets. And he tightened his game up and he didn't panic and he played well. But Musetti didn't push him. It was a total non-entity, that final set. And I think that's unacceptable, really. And that may be a bit harsh, but that's how I feel about it.
Fang-free zone.
Mm. Yeah, he is. He was like a junior, really. And that's perhaps unfair to juniors that have got fangs. But, you know, he needs to improve.
But juniors do have fangs. This yes. is the old "can you grow fangs" discussion. I mean, we had a discussion tonight on this sofa about whether there's something sort of something worse than having no fangs, like sort of anti-fang. That was how I was feeling about Lorenzo Musetti. He was in negative fang territory.
Well,
I agree with you. I forgive a lull at the start of the third set. Absolutely, these are the rhythms of a five-set match. There are lulls. Nobody is at full pelt throughout a five-setter, let alone somebody with his level of experience. But there was no surge at the start of the fourth, let alone at the start of the fifth.
No, he did a bit of a Rory McIlroy and picked it up halfway through and got a bit of a spurt on, and then it was too late.
Yeah, at least he's won four majors already.
Well, we can ask Mary tomorrow, can you grow fangs?
Does Lorenzo Musetti have fangs? I mean, no. Sorry, Mary.
The capacity to grow.
I'll happily chat it over with you, but we know the answer.
Yeah, I don't have much more to add. I think you've said
That's
it well.
That's done with this match.
You've said it well on Lorenzo Musetti. I thought the end of the first set was a bit worrying from a Tsitsipas point of view, in that it was very similar to what we saw against Grigor Dimitrov in Rome, where he was ahead and suddenly his game just deserted him and Musetti took advantage. He did it to a lesser extent against Khachanov in Rome as well. Just, I don't know what it is, a slight lack of confidence, a slight lack of killer instinct. I don't know, but obviously he turned the match around impressively. But I did just look at that first set and think, we've seen that before recently from Tsitsipas. He needs to cut that out of his game if he's going to win this title, I think, against the very best players.
Mm.
But it was an impressive turnaround. He didn't panic, you know, and it would have been easy to panic. First round, such a good opportunity. Yeah, I thought he managed it well from that point on, but the first set was a bit concerning.
So Tsitsipas won his match shortly before 1 a.m. I think shortly after 1 a.m, Gilles Simon triumphed in five sets as well. Not early enough, though, to get himself a retirement presentation. Or actually, hang on, he's got them off the hook, hasn't he?
He's
gone and won. We had an alert at about 12:30 saying Gilles Simon's retirement presentation has been cancelled regardless of the result tonight.
I was going to say, maybe they knew something we don't know, that he's going to get the win.
which, had he lost and not had his Roland Garros retirement presentation, would have been rather sad, given that he had to participate in somebody else's retirement presentation.
Which was always probably going to be a bit earlier more grand,
on
frankly.
Today, yes. Because today was an emotional one, folks, wasn't it? We saw the last ever professional match of the ever popular Joe Wilfried Tsonga. And look, he hasn't been a force in tennis for quite some time, has he? He's physically looked a shadow of himself. He had the diagnosis with sickle cell disease a few years ago. He hasn't been a force for some time, but he's still been a presence somehow in the game. And he deserved a send-off. And boy, did Roland Garros deliver. Well, first and foremost, he delivered, because for a very long time, he gave the pack crown inside Philippe Chatrier a match, a real match. You got to commentate, David, on that first set, which sounded absolutely electric against Casper Ruud.
Yeah, it was. It wasn't me who said it. It was one of you or Hannah, that he was giving Philippe Chatrier his greatest hits in the space of those first two sets, reminding us who he used to be as a tennis player. And that is a marauding, swashbuckling, incredibly powerful, athletic, great touch human being on the tennis court who could just take the racket out of an opponent's hands. I mean, Casper Ruud doesn't mess about. He's got a pretty violent forehand of his own. Sometimes he's being knocked back on his heels by the sheer brute force of this guy's shot making. And it was just so emotional in that stadium, the way the crowd reacted to him. And yeah, the stuff at the end, it was perfect, really. I think it was one of the best. I know it went on a bit, but I didn't mind, actually. It was one of the best post-career moments that I've witnessed. And he called it, I think, the best moment of his career, which is quite something.
One of the best moments of my career actually came before the episode of This Is Your Life, delivered by Roland Garros after the match, and that was the singing of Le Marseillaise.
Oh, goodness.
By the crowd. I mean, it has been somewhat coloured by what immediately followed it, which was a quite bizarre series of events, but we'll always have that moment. I've now heard Matt sing along to the Le Marseillaise.
Oh, really?
Full lyrics, yeah.
Yes, it is one of the things I can do is sing the chorus of the Marseillaise. And no, I'm not going to do it now.
I tried, folks.
But yeah, I just felt like I had to join in that moment. We were actually in a sort of studio, weren't we, when it started, and we ran out to be able to hear the full effect of it. And it was spine tingling. And then
Tsonga had just broken, hadn't he? So it was a set apiece, two sets to one rather, to Casper Ruud, and it looked all but done, didn't it? Tsonga was, you know, a physical shadow of even himself at the start of the match, let alone his, you know, former peak self. And then just clung in there in the fourth set. And then he breaks to find himself serving for the fourth set. And it's at that change of ends, at that sit down, that the chorus of La Marseillaise breaks out. And it, you feel like that was the prelude to sort of everybody settling in for an epic fifth set.
Yeah, and it couldn't have gone in a more different direction so suddenly. It was weird. It was very weird. It was such a high, the Marseillaise. You know, everyone was emotional. It was amazing. And then literally the first serve that Tsonga hit of that 6-5 game, trying to take it to a fifth, he popped his shoulder or did something to his arm or his back or...
Something dramatic.
And you saw him sort of hunch over in pain, and then the second serve he hit was barely a serve. He just patted it over the net, and it was like, oh God, what's happened?
There were groans after every ball that he struck, and then he obviously he gets broken to love. Then there's a medical timeout before the tiebreak, which he's obviously very regretfully having to call for, but he's just trying to finish the match at this point. And there was a wonderful moment of sportsmanship from Casper Ruud, and he said, look, it's fine, mate, take all the time you need. And then, look, it was a 7-love tiebreak to Casper Ruud, who handled himself just brilliantly in an incredibly difficult situation. Immediately after the match, they start setting up for this incredibly elaborate presentation ceremony for Joe Wilfred Tsonga, and then suddenly they announce, and now let's hear a few words from Casper Ruud. And that you realize they are sort of going through with the formality of getting an interview with the winner, and there's almost a sort of internal groan but it's almost an external groan for everybody. Poor Casper Ruud, he dealt with that brilliantly. He said, I don't want to talk about the match, I want to talk about Joe.
Yeah, that was and actually in the end it added to the occasion.
It did.
Because you got somebody who has just gone toe to toe with the guy for 3 hours and a bit, and has tried to be ruthless and has succeeded. He did his job professionally perfectly, and yet he summed up, I think, how most of the locker room feels towards Joe Wilfred Tsonga, those that have encountered him over the last 15 years. I've not heard a negative word about the guy in all the time I've worked in the sport.
Yeah, no, me neither. It felt like a fitting occasion. Obviously, it was sad that the way it ended, but actually, you know, we got to see Tsonga impose his game, impose the force of his personality on a match one last time, which is something I always associate with him. We got those sort of gentle words of his afterwards, which always juxtapose with his very big and loud game on the court. And actually, I think I really realised, not for the first time, because of course I knew this, but it became very clear to me today, just how much of a big deal he is in France. You know, he is the best male French tennis player in a very long time, since Yannick Noah, you know, in terms of his consistency, his ability to win big matches, and they love him here. And there was a kind of end of era feeling, really, as they brought on Gasquet and Monfils and Simon. Obviously, Simon has already announced that he's going to be retiring. Gasquet and Monfils cannot be that far behind, and Joe Wilfred Tsonga is kind of the leader of that group. And it was nice to see them all together, but it did feel, you know, quite poignant, really.
Yeah, very poignant. And of course, they brought on everybody Joe Wilfred Tsonga has ever met. I was surprised, David, you weren't out there, quite frankly. I was expecting them to say former media director of...
Well,
if the Aegon Fevertree well, championships, David
from
Lord.
Above, as you pointed out, Catherine Gilles Moreton,
yes,
looks a lot like you, David.
Oh, does he?
He's a very, very tall man with a combination of brown and grey hair.
Oh, well,
with a certain sort of air of authority about him.
Oh, okay.
As anyway, yes, David wasn't invited onto court, but pretty much everybody else was. The first few people they invited on was a series of sort of, it was very, very sweet, obviously people that meant a lot to Tsonga, but, you know, it wasn't Gasquet, it wasn't anybody that the public would have known. And one of them had a backpack on.
I think they were his former coaches, weren't they?
Yes, they were. But they looked like they'd just sort of...
just rocked in.
Yeah, and there was no sort of cloakroom, nowhere to put their bags down or anything. And they're just...
rucksack.
You've just got to go on now. Just go on with everything you're holding. There's no... like a fire alarm had gone off or something. So out they came, and then his wife came out, and his kids, and his parents came out, and...
they did the video.
Yeah. Andy Murray participated in a retirement video. Which
for someone else.
Yeah. Which is quite something.
Can I ask you both a question about Joe Wilfred Tsonga? Did he underachieve? Or did he fulfil his potential? Because I was looking at his record. He got 6 wins over, I think, Nadal, Federer and Djokovic. And he got 2 wins against Murray. You know, I mean, look, he lost more against all of them. But I just sort of think, you know, Australian Open final, when he threw Nadal around like a rag doll in the semi-final, 6-2, 6-3, 6-2. He came back from 2 sets love down at Wimbledon to beat Roger Federer. He won the Davis Cup. He won an Olympic silver medal in doubles. Masters 1000 titles, lots of Grand Slam semi-finals. But raw materials-wise, I know he had injuries, but what do you think?
I think it's very difficult to say that he underachieved, you know, given the era he was in, given what he did achieve. I would point to one match where I felt like he didn't perform his best, and that was the 2013 French Open semi-final.
Was that the one after the Djokovic?
Yes, the one after
It was the one after he'd beaten Federer in the quarters, and he played David Ferrer in the semis.
It was the second semi-final, wasn't it? And the first semi had been epic.
Nadal, Djokovic.
Yep.
It was an amazing match.
Yeah.
And he came out and the crowd
was flat as a pancake.
And
I remember watching it with
flat.
You, David, in the media bar at Queen's.
We didn't want to look.
And everybody commenting on how bizarre it was that match, you know, peak Tsonga coming out, a completely, you know... as draws go, he's not facing Nadal or Djokovic, and it had a strange feel about it right from the word go.
It looked like he was on his own in the stadium, as though he'd been maybe forced to play the match in his dreams, and his dreams are of a deserted pandemic type situation in the Châtelier, really.
No one's dreams are of a deserted pandemic type situation, David.
Bad dreams.
We've learned anything. Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, that's the only match that I look back on. I mean, maybe there are others, but that's the one that immediately comes to mind and stands out. Other than that, he had a weakness. He had the backhand, which was a weakness, and the big four picked on it and could exploit it.
And actually, that's what kind of turned the match for Ruud, because he kept on making this silly decision to run around his backhand and hit inside in forehands, opening up the whole of the cross-court forehand for Tsonga. And then finally, he figured it out. Oh, I've just got to go the other way and pick on that backhand like the others have all done. But just as a final point about Tsonga, he's always brought me joy watching him, you know, whether it's just the awe of when he's on, or just the look in his eyes when he's celebrating victory or he's engaging with the crowd. I think a lot of him.
He was a show, Tsonga, and he had the iconic celebration which you found yourself waiting for. I was sort of waiting for it today, but then realised that
was the only
he popped
hit
his shoulder
we
out.
Didn't get. Yeah, the only hit we didn't get on the reel. On the reel today, but my goodness, what a career and what a man! And it'll be interesting to see what he does next, won't it? So that was on Châtelier. It delayed Paola Badosa and Fiona Ferro coming out. They had to come out to a completely empty stadium. Really felt for them both. I mean, almost sort of 2013 French Open semi-final vibes. Poor Fiona Ferro.
You
felt like
her.
She, you know, that match had been scheduled there, and at that time, you know, to get the crowd behind Fiona Ferro, and she didn't get that. And look, she's a shadow of the player that she briefly was during pandemic tennis. I saw a few games of that. There weren't many games to watch. Paola Badosa crushed her, but she was missing by a lot. Really, really missing. Yeah.
And it felt to me that Badosa was pulling the margins in today. Mm. I wondered how she'd handle the situation she'd found herself in, of feeling a bit anxious and not feeling really that good recently. Well, it seemed that she just thought, okay, well, I'm just going to hit the ball really hard, try and get my rhythm, but down the middle, more or less. And it, well, worked a treat.
Good matchup for her today, I think. Good match to just find her feet and avoid a first round banana skin. I want to head over to Longlen next for a match that we all watched a portion of together. Because I think it all ties in with the whole crowd thing, French player thing, where it definitely ties in with all of that. We watched the final set and a half of Hugo Gaston beating Alex de Minaur, a match that went to a deciding set 10-point tiebreak. I think it's the first of those in French Open history. I think. I haven't heard of another.
No, I think Karatsev was involved in one a couple of days ago.
Oh, was he?
Yes.
Did he win it?
You're right, actually.
No, he didn't.
No, he did not.
He lost, yeah.
Oh.
Can't remember who against
him. Aslan Karatsev did not win this week. Okay. Well, anyway, one of the first. Yes. We were lucky enough to be there. It was one of those moments when you were in it and feeling the atmosphere and witnessing it. I remember thinking, well, obviously, we're going to lead the podcast with this. Obviously, this is the biggest thing happening. In that moment, it feels all-consuming and like the biggest thing that's happening in the world and has ever happened in the world. But of course, it's just Hugo Gaston winning a round at the French Open against a bloke that doesn't particularly like playing on clay, and it probably won't mean anything in the bigger picture, and it's just all about the moment.
Mm. Yeah, and that's what I love about this place. That's what I love about the French Open. It elevates matches that on paper anywhere else wouldn't be that big a deal. You know, there'd be nice matches, there'd be good tennis and all the rest of it, but I'm in love with this place, this atmosphere. I could sit in those press seats near the court on Longlen all day, quite happily, and not move, you know, especially when the French players are in action. The crowd, I think it's the best tennis crowd I've had access to. I mean, and I know it's only just happening now, but it's like it all the time. Every time there's a French player playing, especially if they raise their level because of them, and the crowd then rise to them. I mean, I was so gutted when I had to leave that match because I had to go and do my job, go on BBC Radio. But you know, you two were left with it, and I dare say the end was great.
There was an underarm serve, David.
Oh, dear.
There was an underarm.
Oh, dear. It was amazing.
Didn't he lose that game?
He lost the game. He won the point.
Did he?
He won the point.
He was break point down at 6-5 in the fifth.
This is Gaston, obviously.
Yeah, so of course he thought, now's the time for an underarm serve.
He's a funny player.
He's an inexplicable tennis player.
I mean,
when we arrived,
the first shot he hit was a tweener.
Yeah. Oh, that's it, wasn't it? When we'd arrived, yeah.
The first shot we saw him hit was a tweener, and I thought,
what are you doing?
Oh, yes.
And not a running backwards, back to the net, you know, force tweener. Nick Kyrgios.
It was because he hadn't moved his feet after he'd served. Yeah.
Can't be bothered to get out of the way.
He tanked that fourth set, didn't he?
He lost it 6-love, and then he went 3-love down in the fifth.
He lost 9 games in a row in the fourth and fifth set and won the match. I mean, that is bizarre.
And yet that doesn't feel that surprising. When you watch him, he feels like he's sort of managing the five sets in his own way.
Oh, totally, he was doing that. Yeah, he was managing energy levels.
He would almost be fuming.
I think. Well, he was very cross with the crowd.
Was he?
Yeah, he said he thought they crossed the line, cheering his double faults as they were.
Yeah, I mean, they were. They were cheering his double faults and his errors.
There was one important double fault where they roared like a goal had been scored. And I did think, if I'm Dimonor, I'm fuming.
And there was a moment where he was stepping up to serve, and you know the crowd were raucous and they were just quietening down. And just as he was about to start his motion, someone shouted quite close to the court. I don't know if Alex Dimonor speaks enough French to understand, but someone shouted, "On est chez nous." Which means you're in our house.
Wow.
Which is...
Wow, that is...
So hostile.
That is...
I hope he didn't understand that, but it was...
But that is the bit, as a spectator, I just can't get enough of. I just... Seeing these players be forced to go into the lion's den like that, and the opposite of what it does to these French players. I can't imagine how they feel. It must be the best feeling in terrace.
Alex de Menor looked like he was dealing with it really well for quite a long time, and then it was like suddenly the dam burst, and he just wanted to kill everybody.
Yes, there was a moment, I think maybe the penultimate point of the match, he'd made an error, and a couple of people in the front row were heckling him, basically, and he just gave them a sarcastic thumbs up. He had had enough of that stadium. And
yeah, there was a bloke in a Roger Federer hat.
Heckling him.
Yeah.
You don't need that.
But, I mean, it was an extremely fun experience being on that court. I mean, and both players contributed, because Gaston was the sort of perfect amount of flaky.
Yeah,
you know, he'd served for the match twice and messed it up twice, but he
the first time he served for it, he hit three terrible drop shots against the fastest player in the world.
There is so much going on in his mind when he plays. He's thinking, I'm sure of it, all the time. What shot shall I play now? What shot shall I play now? It's incredible to watch.
And sometimes he changes his mind mid-stroke.
Or is it just literally instinct? I wonder whether that is a split-second thought, or whether it's just a kind of reaction, as though...
I think it's thought.
Does he feel it?
I think he's having an awful lot of thoughts.
Yeah, there's so much in his game. He's got so many possibilities, and he frequently picks the wrong one. But
when he gets it right,
it's fantastic. And Dimonor...
And he's tiny.
He is tiny. Yeah, and I enjoy watching Dimonor play tennis a lot as well, and he's stiffened, though. He doesn't use his wrists. He's all arm in his ground strokes. And he played a couple of bad games and not a particularly good tiebreak. But it was a great, great match.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High-quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
It was a pretty good day for French players today. Gaston won. We've just seen Simon win. Elise Cornet blasted past Misaki Doi in the opening match on Châtrier. Caroline Garcia beat Taylor Townsend in straight sets. So decent results for French players. And Richard Gasquet won yeah. as well. Almost forgot that because it was held over from yesterday. But he picked up where he left off and beat Lloyd Harris in straight sets. Denis Shapovalov, the biggest casualty so far in the men's draw, beaten by Holger Rune pretty straightforwardly.
Yeah.
Quite frankly, made a bit of a go of it in the third set, took it to a tiebreak. The two sets before that, he won four games.
Yeah, 6-3, 6-1, 7-6 it was. And he was pretty disgusted with his own performance, Shapovalov. He said, I didn't show up. He didn't give an awful lot amount of credit to Rune. He said that he felt like he would have lost to most players in the draw. And, you know, maybe that's a very honest assessment. And he wasn't saying that Rune played badly or didn't deserve to win or anything, but he felt like it was mainly on him. And he did make, you know, some interesting comments in the press conference. He was asked about Jamie Delgado and why he's split with him. Rob Moore asked him that question, and he gave such a vague answer. His exact words were, something is missing with Jamie. Nothing in particular, just something missing.
Okay.
Clears it right up.
Well, yeah.
Well, we'll see, won't we?
It didn't sound like a guy who had really thought that through to me. And he kept saying that Peter Polanski's helping him a lot. So we'll see. But I don't love that decision.
Without
knowing the ins and outs.
Holger Rune is a talent and is going places, it appears. He's certainly having a good period, and maybe this is the start of something for him. So on that level, maybe not such a bad loss as some might be in the first round, but he wasn't really competitive. It's certainly in two of the sets. And he's got Wimbledon semi-finals points about to drop from his ranking.
And he said that was on his mind. He said that he felt a pressure today and in this tournament to try and go far to make up some points, because he knows that he's losing a lot and he's not going to be able to gain any at Wimbledon. And that was on his mind and felt like it affected his performance.
Yeah, he said, and Karolina Pliskova said very similar comments, actually, although Pliskova went into more detailed explanation, that they both strongly opposed the tour's decision to take ranking points away at Wimbledon. But they both have massive skin in the game. Denis Shapovalov has semi-final points to defend and Karolina Pliskova final points to defend. Now, they both completely fronted up to that. They said, look, I've got interests here. And Pliskova was particularly honest about it. But it was just a stark reminder that pretty much everybody that's expressed an opinion, that opinion has pretty much fallen in line with how the situation personally affects them.
Yeah.
And it's not surprising, but it is crap, isn't it? You know, this is ultimately, I know it's sort of extended beyond this because the tour's decision is a retaliation, and it becomes about the politics of tennis and the divided governance structure of tennis. But ultimately, this is about war and slaughter. And so few of the players are able to look beyond how a particular decision affects them on a very personal, basic level. And that's
it's really disappointing,
isn't it? And
yeah.
And it's what made Iga Świątek's answer yesterday.
Absolutely.
All the more impressive, really, that she kind of put herself aside, removed herself a bit from the situation and looked at it, you know, in her words, from a political standpoint. That's what matters most to her.
And it's a disappointing environment. So often when sort of politics intervenes in tennis, as it seems to on a weekly basis, I find myself not really wanting to hear what the majority of players think about it, because unless they are the minority of players that make a point of being informed and educated, I don't find their views particularly relevant, unless it's a matter of, you know, something really specific to being, you know, forehands, backhands, all of that. On these sort of geopolitical issues, unless they're particularly informed and have a big picture appreciation of situations, I don't find their views particularly relevant, to be honest.
Yeah, it's like a vox pop with people outside Sainsbury's on the high street.
Yeah, absolutely.
When they're talking about this really serious...
I understand why they want to express them, but this sort of... I guess it exposes something, doesn't it? This sort of... We've had lots of players saying, you know, I've tried to express how I feel to the WTA or ATP and I feel I haven't been listened to. Well, if they're acting out of principle and what they think is right or wrong, they shouldn't necessarily be listening to their players. Now, obviously that exposes the issue of, is the ATP, is the WTA a players' union? Mm. If it's a players' union, they should be acting in the interests of the players, not out of principle, like a defence lawyer does for their client. Mm. Regardless of whether they're innocent or guilty, you act in their best interests. But, of course, you have this massive conflict at the heart of these organisations where they are part player union, part governing body. But there's the PTPA, I hear you say.
I think the one area I am happy enough to hear their view on is when they are supporting the players that they feel, in their words, have been discriminated against by being banned. That element of it, whilst I think that they're not, I don't believe that they're fully appreciating the wider context of the world, really. But I can understand how they can look at their colleagues, contemporaries on the tour, and think, well, why are they being banned? The points element, yeah, I agree. I don't like just the sort of the selfishness
but
of it.
But hang on. The answer to why are they being banned gets into massive geopolitical and philosophical issues. Mm. It's 2 o'clock in the morning and we can't get into it again right now. But, you know, it comes down to the philosophical question of can an individual be held responsible for the acts of their state? And obviously I don't have an answer to that. I've done a philosophy degree and I don't have an answer to that. But unless you're, you know, appreciating of those being the concerns, I don't know. I'm just...
I mean, they can't be held responsible, and yet at the same time...
They can be.
I'm saying is it's not their fault in any way, but at the same time, you still have to make a decision based on everything, not just the effect it might have on individuals.
There's just so much nuance to it, isn't there? And it's, yeah... Anyway, Yelena Ostapenko suggested she might not play Wimbledon after she beat Lucia Bronzetti. If there are no points, I'm not really sure what I'm going to do. I feel like it's not fair that you can win a tournament and not move one place in the rankings. But she also said that she had a feeling the tours might change their minds, which is kind of what Naomi Osaka indicated yesterday. Again, I think we would all be surprised. But
The one thing that was suggested to me is that they might keep the points from last year is one thing I heard.
That just punishes a different set of people, doesn't it?
No, it does. I'm talking no points.
Could there not be 50%? They retain 50% of their points, but that's just a fudge, isn't it? That's just... Anyway, Benoit Paire, also a post-loss loose cannon. He lost to Ilya Ivashka today. He told the French press, I will go to Wimbledon to pick up a check and play an exhibition.
Apparently he asked to come into press. He wasn't requested. He asked to come in.
I requested myself.
So that he could say that. I understand.
God. Wow.
Let me tweet it.
Wanted an audience. I don't know. Had some time to kill before the Joe Wilfried Tsonga ceremony. What else happened today? Andre Rublev rather let himself down, didn't he, in his four-set win over Sunwoo Kwon. He lost the opening set and almost got himself defaulted, quite frankly. He almost, by a whisker, indirectly struck a line judge in the head when smashing a ball into the umpire's chair, and then proceeded to do some smashing of racket into the ground when he went to sit down. Look, we said this before, men's tennis has a problem. Well, Andrei Rublev is a good egg.
He's one of the worst examples right now. He's just been lucky, frankly, that he hasn't hurt somebody or hit somebody. I mean, if you think what he's done a couple of times has been not much different, for instance, to what Novak Djokovic did at the US Open. It's just that Djokovic happened to strike somebody. And then if the thing is with Rublev, if he has something like that happen and he ends up on a probation or something like some of the others have had, is he going to be able to control himself? He doesn't look like he can. He doesn't look like he can control himself. And I think he needs to properly attend to that, because it's I can't watch him happily anymore.
He got a warning, though, code violation and nothing more. I mean, the ATP, they've stitched themselves up with the punishment that they dished out to Alexander Zverev for his behaviour in Acapulco, haven't they? They've set the bar so high for what gets even a sort of fairly mild punishment, that anything falling below that bar can only get a lesser punishment. He said, to his credit, in press afterwards, obviously doesn't make up for it entirely, but at least he said, I lost my mind for a moment and I regret what I did. This is unprofessional from my side and hopefully I will never do it again.
So. You keep saying that, though. I mean, show us then.
Maybe he will.
Hopefully he will. I like him. I don't dislike him, but I'm a bit done with the excuses, to be honest.
Yeah, he's got some growing up to do, hasn't he? There was some real grit from Aryna Sabalenka late on Longlen to fight back and beat the French woman Chloe Paquet. Very far from her best, Aryna Sabalenka, and she's been that all year, quite frankly. I was impressed that she won today, to be honest, because she was setting a break down, looked completely out of it. She's got no form, no confidence to draw upon whatsoever, crowd against her. And actually, she was really effusive with the crowd in her on-court interview. She said, thank you so much for staying and for cheering so loud. I know you were against me, but it meant a lot. To be playing in that atmosphere, so that was a nice touch. Same goes a little bit for Simona Halep, who did some winning ugly of her own versus Natasha Schunk. Anybody got anything on Natasha Schunk? Lucky loser. Well, she got a set off Simona Halep today.
It's good going.
Good going.
Yes, Simona Halep was asked something like, What do you want to take from this match, or what do you want to do moving forward in this tournament? And she just said, play better. I think she was not particularly happy with how she played today out on the Simone Mathieu Stadium. But, you know, sometimes you just got to get through matches like that.
Yeah, absolutely. Jannik Sinner was a winner in three sets today, as was Daniil Medvedev, who looked pretty comfortable out there, didn't he, for a first outing at Roland Garros. But his opponent was sort of half mummified. It was not really a contest on the physical front. Facundo Bagnis had his one of his lower legs.
It was like knee down, wasn't it?
Yeah. I thought he was wearing a long sock. And then I thought, oh, no. Oh, dear. He's injured. He's lame, as Simon Briggs said. And, yeah, Medvedev cruised.
Yeah, a bit of an awkward contest. Sebastian Korda won today. Daniel Collins, Jessica Pegula, Francis Tiafoe.
Jessica Pegula needed 10 match points.
Oh, crikey.
And this was Francis Tiafoe's first ever French Open win, I think.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Wow. I'm
Yeah, so lots stamp. Of very winners strong. for the USA today. Very, very, very quick quiz through the order of play for tomorrow, folks. It starts on Philippe Chatrier at midday with Angelique Kerber, match 2 of 7, against Elsa Giacomo, the French woman. Then it's Alexander Zverev against Sebastian Baez. Not sure why that's on Chatrier for me. But anyway, it is Alexander Zverev against Baez. Then third on, match of the day, Belinda Bencic against Bianca Andreescu. Yes, please, feed it into my veins. And then not before 8:45 tomorrow night, so probably first ball at around 8:15, 57.
I mean, yeah, they're not keeping to these times.
No, but they've got to get the DJ set in, David. Right. It's essential. Corentin Moutet against Rafael Nadal. We learned today that Moutet is a bit of a Rafael Nadal fanboy, and that never bodes well, does it? Emirati Kanu kicks things off on court Suzanne Longlen at 11 a.m. She takes on Alexander Sasnovich. Mukovic against Sakkari over there. Djokovic is on Longlen tomorrow against Alex Molchan, of course, coached by his former coach Marion Vida. He said, look, it's just another opponent for me, but it is the first time I'll have seen Marion in the opposing box, and I'm not looking forward to it, he said. Yeah, I mean, how could he be?
I think I'm glad he said probably that. Probably the thing that would make him most emotional, really, if more or less, that sort of thing, because he's always been very clear just how close he is to him, isn't he?
Korda against Gasquet is last on Longlen, and then over on Simon Mathieu tomorrow is where you will find Carlos Alcaraz. You've got Coco Gauff over there, John Isner against Gregoire Barrère, and then third on, Albert Ramos Vinolas against Carlos Alcaraz. And then if you want some more one-handed backhand action, Diane Parry is last on Simon Mathieu against Camilla Osorio. Plenty more tomorrow as well. Sloane Stephens, Dimitrov against Chorich, Taylor Fritz, Victoria Azarenka. It's all happening, folks. And of course, we'll be back with another daily podcast tomorrow. We have our very, very important mascots. We have Cooper, the cat. Not sure who's looking after Cooper because his owners are here in Paris.
That's right. Yeah, Drew and David.
Cooper's just out on the town, sort of Macaulay Culkin style.
Resourceful.
Yeah. Yeah.
Go on, Cooper.
Getting into hijinks. We have our own mascots. I've got Carter. David's got Darwin.
Right, Darwin.
Matt's got the dearly departed Gerald the Cat. Billie Jean has Billie Jean King and Alana Kloss. We have our executive producers and top blokes, Chris Albertley and Kyle Weingartner. And we have shout-outs, Matt.
We do. We have Stuart Murphy in Belfast.
Hi, Stuart.
Like Murphy Jensen, one of the two Jensen brothers.
Have we ever had a Stuart as a tennis player? I can't think of one.
There was a guy at Queen's last year called Stuart Parker.
There was.
Because I remember thinking it was a bit
like
Scott
Jersey.
Parker.
He's from Jersey. Mm.
This is good knowledge.
Yeah.
I bet Stuart Murphy could beat him.
Thank you, Stuart.
Yeah.
For support.
We also have Kateri Swavely from Eastern Pennsylvania.
Wow.
Oh, East. Not a specific town, just a region.
No, I think maybe the town is Eastern.
Oh, okay.
Pennsylvania is where the office was based.
Yes, Scranton. As in, is it Eastern, Pennsylvania?
Yes, it is. It's Eastern, Pennsylvania.
Oh,
wow. Okay.
A city.
How fun. Everywhere's a city in America, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a city in Pennsylvania with a population
of
26,800 in the 2010 census.
The gall of calling yourself a city when you've got 26...
Yeah. Poor Reading.
Reading's been trying to be a city for the past few decades.
I was reading about that.
Mm. Hmm.
Anyway, thanks so much for being our friend.
Yes, thank you.
And final one tonight is Moshi Gitlis from Tel Aviv. And Moshi says, Jimmy Connors won his last title at ATP Tel Aviv
in
1989, and I was a ball boy at that tournament.
Wow.
Love that.
That's so cool. Moshi, you are.
I like the name Moshi as well. Very good.
Brilliant.
Love that. Love these little bits of background.
Mm, they're good, aren't they?
Mm, really like it. So thank you, Moshi. Thank you to all of our shout-outs today. Thank you to all friends of the Tennis Podcast who have helped us to be here in Paris recording podcasts at 2 a.m. There is nowhere else we would rather be. Matt's still got a newsletter to get out, so make sure you subscribe to the newsletter for all his hard work not to go to waste. Make sure you, what else should people do? Leave us an Apple Podcasts review. That's a thing that you could do. Yeah.
Tell your friends all about the pod.
Tell your friends.
And follow us on Instagram. We'd love to get to 10,000.
We would. Oh, that rare bit of unashamed promo there from Matt.
Well, just saying. You can do extra things when you get to 10,000.
Yeah. And Catherine's good at Instagram stories, I'm telling you.
Very good.
We're closing in, folks. Do all of those things and tune in tomorrow because we'll be back with another podcast. We'll speak to you then.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.